Secular campuses are being transformed, but the students need your help. Last year, students at 41 secular universities asked to start TI chapters. Only 10 could be funded. The rest are still waiting. Please, give a student the yes they've been praying for. They're ready, but they can't share the truth without you. Your gift before September 15th can launch a new TI chapter and change lives. Go to ThomisticInstitute.org/donate or use the link in this episode to give today.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
My final talk for this collection is entitled Insight, Idolatry, and AI, and I want to focus in particular on AI-aided decision-making and the phenomenon of AI bias in the fields of medicine and criminal justice. There are a few relevant points from previous talks that I want to pick up on and remind us of in order to weave them through the talk I'll give today. And in the first place, on the first day, I distinguished between intelligentsia as the subjects, the rational, relational subjects, hold, an experienced intuitive hold or a self-orientation toward reality or toward some object through loving judgment. So we set ourselves in relation to something outside ourselves, and this is what understanding is for the early church fathers, especially Augustine. And then the modern sense of artificial intelligence refers to a system's behavioral efficacy. It doesn't matter how it does it, just that it gets the job done in achieving externally specified goals. On the second day, I looked at the meaningfulness of artificial intelligence, pointing out that our machines have meaning from being framed by our intentionality, that as with books, we attribute meaning to the machine that we are using, and we structure its contingent functioning so that it will carry through those meanings. Neural networks, I proposed, map the rationes, the God-given coherence of things in the world, to human-chosen purposes and meanings, which means, of course, that if our chosen purposes and meanings don't actually respect the nature of the things that we're using, we're going to get into trouble. On the third day, talking about apparently personal artificial intelligence and relationships with it, I introduced the concept, the Augustinian concept of pride, which judges everything in terms of what I can consume or control, and thus the concept of the idol as something that hides what it cannot control and allows some measure of control over what one deems to be important. On the fourth day, today, I'm going to look at AI decision-making systems and the phenomenon of AI bias as a reduction or distortion of the scope of human activity. And thus, bias becomes a category in artificial intelligence that can be analyzed under the concept of idolatry. All right, to begin. So first, we're going to talk about bias and its relationship to the theological concept of idolatry. Bias is a rightly unpopular phenomenon in our day. But in one sense, we are all, and we must be, biased. When we deliberate about some action, when we want to select a course of action rather than just follow the suggestion of intuition or habit or impulse, then we have to exercise our intelligence, our intelligentsia. That is, we have to capture and interpret reality in order to navigate it. We have to schematize it to make sense of and direct our action within reality and toward it. So even before we deliberate about action, we make interpretive reductions. They're just part of our biological makeup. We have selective sensitivities to the environment that we confront, in how our nervous system makes stimuli feel, and in our uniquely rational tendency to wonder about and conceptualize the things we experience. We're always filtering, we're transducing, we're interpreting reality at various levels, the sensory all the way up to the intellective. Whether inborn, habitual, or carefully cultivated, Our reductions of the world yield insight. We are revolted by the smell of rot. We don't have to engage in an analysis or conceptual inquiry into what's bad about rotten meat. We smell it, it smells bad, and we don't get near it. So this is a reduction that it gives insight. We tell children that some berries are edible and others are only for birds. We discuss race in its biological and its socially constructed dimensions. And we talk about degrees of realism in our accounts of how we know the world. So we both make use of reductions and we are aware of the contingency of these reductions. Particularly helpful in the case of medicine are these cultivated reductions. Skilled clinicians must develop a sense for what matters in bringing the patient to full health. That is, they have to notice things about the patient, and they have to notice the things that matter for the sake of health. Doctors seek to name what is there, and they are attuned to what is nameable. On the other hand, though, our perceptual and conceptual attunements are called undesirable biases, when they are not so much selective of the scope of human action as they are distortive within it. I cannot, but bees can, see ultraviolet reflecting markings on flowers. And I should have put a sort of pseudo photograph of it in there because in the ultraviolet spectrum, all the flowers with the sweet nectar have these kind of runways on their petals, like, come in here, it's gonna be amazing. And so the bees just like follow these tracks like they're landing on an aircraft carrier with giant gallon jugs of sugar inside it. But we don't see that. And this isn't really a bias because in a certain sense, we don't need it. Getting into the interior of flowers by crawling along a petal or flying in is not part of the scope of human action. So that they can see it and that I can't, and that fire pains me, these are examples of selectivity for the scope of human action. If a three-month-old has greater comfort with faces that are colored like that of her primary caregiver, a child may expect that a secretary will be female, and these are bounds that ought to be expanded by rearing and experience, lest they become biases governing one's life. Because what may be beneficial to family bonding, preferring a face that looks like your primary caregiver, and statistically accurate in waiting rooms, assuming that the secretary will be female, is nonetheless a distortion when it becomes a conscious or unconscious norm governing one's societal experience and behavior. The tension between how our images of reality make it navigable and how they may distort it is markedly apparent in the phenomenon of AI bias. Contemporary machine learning techniques, especially the deep neural networks that dominate today's landscape, have yielded AI systems that, despite astounding successes, are also notorious for their biases. Especially in areas of race and gender, these biases run the gamut. Some are jarring. An AI system developed to reconstruct a high-resolution image of pixelated faces, reconstructed Barack Obama's pixelated face in high resolution as Caucasian, because most of the faces in the training set for that system were white. And so confronted with a black face, reconstructed it as a white man. Other biases are troubling. Amazon's face recognition software, once marketed to law enforcement agencies, was 31% less effective at determining the gender of women of color than of light-skinned men. And that can be a bit of a problem if the police are using the system to find someone. Some of these biases can also be life-changing in rather negative ways. Again, Amazon's experimental hiring algorithm discriminated against women. And they had a hard time figuring this one out until they realized that it was deprioritizing applications that used words like collaboration or realization, words that tended to appear with higher frequencies in applications by women. The reason it deprioritized these words was because Amazon had tended to hire fewer women, and so the AI was just carrying on this unconscious policy or outcome by simply eliminating all the applications that had markers of having been written by women without ever having female as a category in the selection process. It just noticed that certain ways of writing didn't tend to get hired, so it wasn't going to recommend for hiring those ways of writing. Some of these biases can be life-changing to a rather frightening degree. Prison sentences are influenced by racially correlated inaccuracies in the COMPASS algorithm's prediction of how likely someone is to relapse into crime after being released. And a hospital software for predicting care needs consistently deprioritized equally sick Black patients. All of these biases are distortions within the scope of human activity. They concern our use of human-made systems to make decisions about fellow human beings. We call it bias rather than selectivity because our reliance on these AIs for decision-making, our pursuit of some good by using them, tends to harm another, or we don't even get the good we were looking for. Biases can arise from a variety of sources, which I will discuss in this talk. The method of training, the architecture of the system, the interpretation of the results, and combinations of such factors. Each etiology calls for a unique solution, but the general predicament can be illuminated as it applies to our own ethical lives by setting it within the Christian discourse on the idol. So I'd like to make three claims in what remains here. First, by considering the difference between human and artificial intelligence, we can see how technology becomes an idol when it is wielded to exercise seemingly total control over what we cannot understand, or with Amazon's hiring, what we don't want to be involved in. We're trying to offload the work. Second, contemporary AI's deep neural networks are open to idolatrous misuse at several levels, both because they are an image that can seem to replace reality, and because they somewhat echo the character of our own idolatrous minds. And lastly, a theological solution to idolatry through engagement with God suggests that optimistic visions of an AI-controlled future in which we will be able to give up responsibility for our decisions are essentially inadequate to the needs of human life. In the end, to serve and protect or to do no harm, we must allow human love a scope beyond what technology can represent. All right, so let's look at the neural network as an image and as an idol. Remember, we talked about the Augustinian notion of intelligentsia, a self-positioning toward reality by a judgment of love. Decision-making, human decision-making, always encodes some stance of love, some assessment of goodness, some assessment of what matters. But modern intelligence, artificial intelligence, as efficacy and goal achievement, wants the fruit, action based on value, without the personal engagement, the commitment to a particular judgment on the part of a seeing person. This is what happens when we offload the decision to a mechanism. The goal that the AI optimizes for is actually still a human-generated stance of love, decision, and valuation, but we don't acknowledge it. We have labeled the options among which we ask the AI to select, but then we relinquish responsibility for the way in which we use the AI or the options that we have labeled. The AI can see, as it were, more than we can. These systems, like I mentioned last time, can predict the courses of storms, they can predict the habits of consumers, they can predict the outcomes of surgeries. But nonetheless, these powers of correlation, prediction, and decision exist within the framing of goals and utilities that are labels and are quantified training measures implicitly in code. Even taking away from AI, prescinding from AI, this is a problem within the social sciences. You may have heard of the replication crisis when many key experiments in social psychology that have been cited thousands of times and were incredibly influential on the field turned out not to be replicable. They ran the same experiments again, they collected the same quantified data, it didn't come out looking the same way. Part of the problem here is that social psychology asks human beings to rate on a scale of 1 to 10 how happy they are, but what that even means on the part of the human beings, even if you get a population large enough that you think you've ironed out all the, you know, individual human variation, it's actually unclear. It's unclear what we're doing when we assign numbers and labels to things. We're not always capturing what's there because sometimes the way that the question is asked is not adequate to the reality in view. If we could simply resolve these questions, we wouldn't even be here, because philosophy would have been solved and finished, you know, maybe a couple thousand years ago. It could have been done. But we don't ever seem to come to the end of it, because living through it is the only way actually to do it. And words and concepts, evaluations, decisions, and intellections have to be lived into. We can guide others into it, but it's very difficult to summarize it by a diagram or a set of bullet points, especially a set of bullet points that we want to feed into an AI system. So when intelligence, the achievement of measurable goals, displaces intelligentsia, our use of tools can become idolatrous. Tools function to extend and facilitate the human will working upon the world. And oftentimes, it is true, we have to work on the world to affect what we do not explicitly understand. And we have ways of doing this well. If you've been to a few weddings, by now you will have seen weddings in which it's clear that the wedded couple took dance lessons last week. And that's cute and charming, because they're there stiffly waltzing, and you can sometimes see them counting. And then one of them starts to laugh because they're tripping over each other's feet, and it's fun, and it's a moment of levity and joy and everything. But they also don't know how to dance. They're trying to work through the rules in their head and remember the sequence of actions, but they're not actually feeling the motions of their bodies. On the other hand, if you see people who really do know how to dance, you're not aware of the fact that they are dancing. You're just aware of the fluidity of motion and the communion of bodies and minds and hearts as they move across the dance floor. Our action is always immersed in a larger context. And our action is at its best when it's fully immersed in that context. We deal with the context, as it were, from within. The couple that can't waltz and that's counting one, two, three, one, two, wait, where were you? What? They're not in the action. They're controlling the action as if they're not experiencing it. This is why it's hard to learn how to sail. I learned how to sail when I was 13. My dad took me on this sailing trip. It was really cool. But it was scary. The first time I got on a sailboat, and it was just sitting there, and the wind slaps the, I don't remember, I think they're called sheets, the narrow ropes. It slaps the sheets against the mast, and it's like, and the sails are going. And then when everything gets into position and the wind comes, and then there's like snap, and everything fills up and it's stiff now, and the sailboat's moving through the water, it's really exciting. You can't pre-instruct someone about that. Just like with music, they have to be in it. So we develop a refined sensibility that we do put a name to, but it's only through the adjustment of our experience and our kind of implicit knowledge of a situation to that situation that we're able to deal with it. That's why it's so hard to quantify and to label. Likewise, there are things about medicine that only experience can give. And if it weren't for understaffing, police forces generally agree that it would be better to have a police officer follow the same beat in the same neighborhood every day and get to know all the people in that neighborhood in order to be able to police it well. What is happening in all these circumstances is an attunement to reality, sometimes simply by living in the reality, sometimes in reverse. Sometimes we give the labels and then people slowly learn how the labels correspond to something deeper that can't fully be explained. Music theory is initially alienating until it becomes a grammar connected to someone's experience of the music. We develop a sense for the good that is in that system. We develop an intelligentsia of it by the way it responds to us. The sailboat doesn't sail well, and then we learn to sail. We trip when we dance, and then we learn to dance. And so our decisions for action must be rooted in this refined sensibility, although sometimes it's only through acting that we develop that sensibility. We begin to form a sense and even concepts that can become observation and theory, and that theory can be alive to us because it lives within that attunement of experience. This is what is just called good sense. So a tool, at its best, becomes a mediator of intimacy with the world. Think about the bow for the violin. The bow stroked across the strings of the violin is not simply a button that one pushes to make the violin go. It becomes a mediator of intimacy with sound, with the vibration of air and string and wood. But it is different when the tool becomes an instrument of control detached from our implicit intelligentsia, when we are set at a remove from the system, when we pull the levers of a system we do not understand to control a reality that we cannot see. And if you think of a very simple example of this, it would that everyone encounters, if you've ever watched YouTube and you get some guy who says, like, wait, before you take another multivitamin, watch this. I never watch those things because they're usually scams. But why do we still not know which nutrition supplement is going to help us live to the age of 105? Because through these things, we're pulling the levers based on trust of a system, our bodily nature, that we don't fully understand. This corresponds to the Augustinian sense of pride, not in a morally reprehensible sense, but just in a tendency to seek security and control over what cannot be understood. Pride is the stance that reduces all things to the scope of what I can control or the fulfillment of the desires that I can name. When we step outside of the system to manipulate it blindly from outside, we subject it to the role of fulfilling only those desires which are encoded in the tools that we use. If any of you are close enough to being teenagers that you remember this, you either will have been or will have known the weightlifting. There are certain boys who reduce their entire corporeality to the measurement that they can get around their chest, and then they try to maximize that. The idol there is the tape measure around their chest, and the maximization that takes place turns out to be rather cartoonish. You can always tell who's in the gym for health and who's in the gym for muscles by their legs. The guys who walk around on little chicken legs with gigantic arms and gigantic chests have never looked at a full-length mirror. Since our intelligentsia here is no longer involved, we are no longer orienting ourselves toward the totality of the good that is involved, the intelligent tool, the tape measure, becomes an idol, an instrument of control that hides its own limits and gives us the illusion of godlike comprehensiveness. It is human to navigate reality in light of images, schemas, and devices that are oriented to action within that reality, but these tools become idols when pride is the Latin word for pride, clings to them in place of reality and denies all that cannot be compassed within their horizon of apprehension and control. What the tape measure can't measure doesn't matter anymore about one's bodily form. All right, now let's look at how neural networks can end up functioning either as images or of idols and see some concrete examples. The neural network, as I have explained, when it has been trained, becomes a sort of mapping from reality, from the reality of interest, as it can be captured by sensors and measurements, to the intentions of human beings, as they can be expressed by the labeled outputs and action selections. It's a kind of artificial memoria in the sense that Augustine has. AI researcher Kate Crawford explains that the network predictively generalizes. It performs an induction by having learned, quote, from specific examples, which data points to look for in new examples, end quote. One might hope that given a rich enough set of examples, the trained network could accommodate the messiness of the real world without reductive bias. But as noted above, this has not proven to be the case. Instead, neural networks often manifest systematically or consistently reproduced classification errors when presented with new examples. There's a canonical example of AI bias that dates back to the late 90s, and I was told this when I was an engineering student, we were taught about it. And I did some research recently because I wanted to cite it in the paper that I'm writing that this talk is working toward. And it turns out that it seems to be an apocryphal story. But the story is that back in the 80s, when neural network technology was brand new, the Defense Department wanted to train a targeting sensor to distinguish between Soviet tanks and German and American tanks for the potential of a war with the Soviet Union in Europe. And they trained the system, and it was amazing, and it worked. It worked perfectly and everything. They trained it on all these pictures. Then they brought it out to test in the field, and it stunk. It kept saying that all the tanks were Soviet tanks, even when the camera was pointed at a very clearly American tank. And they went back to the training pictures to try to figure out what had happened, and it turned out that all the pictures of Soviet tanks had been taken on cloudy days, and all the American tanks were in the bright Arizona sun. And so when they got into the dark forests of Germany, everything looked like a Soviet tank, because really, the system was learning to distinguish between cloudy skies and bright skies, not between American Soviet tanks and American tanks. I've looked that up, and there's an entire history of this case being mentioned in literature about artificial intelligence. But the kind of internet sleuth who was writing this other paper about the history of this example concluded that this had actually never happened, and it had just been a kind of example tossed out by a computer scientist in some meeting of defense investors, and it was not actually true. So there you go. But it's very plausible. It could have happened. So whatever the particulars of this or that case, Augustine's theological analysis of idolatry discloses the deeper principles of AI bias in three potentially idolatrous moments. The human collection of the training data, that would be idolatrous training of the network. The human interpretation of the network activity, idolatrous interpretation. And the network's echoing of the human mind. Because remember, the AI systems we can call echoes of the human mind. For neural networks, yes, there's a kind of analogy there with the biology of the human brain, and that's why it can do a lot of things in a way that's strikingly brain-like. But AI systems are going to, quote-unquote, echo the human mind also in the broader sense that they are always contextualized within the interpretive framework that we have developed, either individually or collectively. We tend to interpret them in a certain way. All right, so the seeds of idolatry can first be sown by how the training data is collected. Classifications, writes Kate Crawford, are technologies that both produce and limit ways of knowing. An example of this is the naming of colors, or as every American child knows, and I don't actually know whether it's true or not, the Eskimos have like 100 different words for snow because they're more attuned. They've named these fine differences. Some theorists of language want to claim that we can only perceive what we have named. The linguist at Columbia, John McWhorter, has written a book called The Language Hoax, the subtitle of which is Why the World Looks the Same in Every Language. And his contention is actually that most languages that don't have a word for something will have found a way to talk about it if that thing is relevant to the life that's lived. And it seems that human beings are capable of perceiving even things for which they don't have names, although it is also culturally true that what is not named or described does tend to be ignored. So it's kind of qualified acceptance of this idea that naming opens us to reality. In presuming to reduce the world accurately to terms, but what I wanted to add is that it's very different for AI. Because the AI is not a mind, because the AI is not a subject, what is not named to the AI simply is not seen. And what is not named on the outputs of the AI cannot be offered as an option. If you've trained the neural network to choose between six different options of action, it's not going to introduce option seven because it doesn't even have an architecture that can. I shouldn't have said what is not named can't be seen. That's not the case that what is not named can't be seen, but what is not submitted among the measured data cannot be seen by the network. So the network's going to be limited by the sensors, by the data that the human designers of the system have collected or that is collectible through the data vectors that are open to the network, but on its outputs, when it's telling us what to do about it, what it doesn't have an output for, what it can't name, it can't express. Often and without acknowledgement, these decisions about the labeling of data, the collection of data for training, flatten complex social, cultural, political, and historical relations into quantifiable entities. So the same problems we find in social science also bedevil the use of AI for similar applications. On the other hand, to avoid making choices like this, to avoid this kind of flattening and reduction, Designers may train systems on numerous measurements gathered by countless devices across multitudinous interactions in the hope that discovering the deep harmonics of the big data, the network will have laid hold of the reality of importance. And this is the case now with the now developed technology of the VLM, the Visual Language Model, instead of the LLM, the Large Language Model, which attempts to combine, both in training and expression, image information and textual information in the hope that this multimodal AI system will actually be able to deal with reality better. Early results from these systems, actually seem to indicate that some of these systems just find shallower shortcuts to deal with the data. They're even worse than the ones that are pure text or pure image. So hopefully a way will be found around that, but it shows that the mere fact of piling in more data of different kinds doesn't necessarily yield a richer system that is deeper. But here too, we choose to believe that one can be measured is all that needs to be measured. Allowing the affordances of our tools, Kate Crawford writes, to become the horizon of truth that determines our action in the real world. These approaches are fraught with idolatrous potential because the supposedly context-free human is made the supposed master over the domain in question. When we treat big data as a suitable stand-in for the world that we're interested in, we deny our role in having chosen it. We seek independence from needing a point of view. And so we practice the potentially prideful illusion of mastery with data as a proxy for our own ultimacy. The AI can find in the data the things that we have trouble finding or naming. But when we try to throw the AI at the problem and step back from it and relinquish our responsibility for engagement with and attunement to it, we essentially, instead of going out onto the dance floor and dancing, we get a motorized automatic wheelchair to spin us around a few times and then put us back at the side and we claim we've danced. It's really not the same thing. We deny our dependence upon and foundation in a larger reality. We deny our limitations by making ourselves arbiters of the relevant data space. All right, secondly, idolatrous interpretation. And here's where things get really interesting. Idolatry beckons us also in how we assess the aboutness of machine learning and in its dependence on our own intentionality. A series of voltage levels on microscopic transistors does not supply its own conceptual interpretation. As I discussed last time, we supply it by framing the device's activities in our conceptual space, just as we do for the letters in books. The machine learning system maps data inputs to predictive or action-selecting outputs in light of our purposes. But are these purposes honored by the input data and the way that we have trained the outputs? Is our conceptual framing of the network actually supported by its activity? And this is the question, is the system doing what we think we've trained it to do? Neural networks are opaque, as I discussed two times ago. Their interior sensitivities are not entirely interpretable. The network cannot signal whether its apparent success actually engages the phenomenon we're interested in, or instead latches on to some correlated but non-determinative variable. For example, a network that takes in prisoners' data points and outputs their chance of committing a crime may appear to reach significant accuracy across a convict population, but it also may have just learned to prioritize people from high-crime zip codes, like the system that flagged as bone fractures all x-rays that happened to bear the barcode of a hospital with the highest proportion of trauma cases. That is a real-world situation that is just like the example of the tanks. So they trained this system to find hairline bone fractures, and it was doing really well. And then they tried to apply it to real x-rays, and it was finding bone fractures that weren't there, and it was missing bone fractures that should have been really obvious. And when they went into it, and you can look with a neural network, like what part of the image is it sensitive to? How use statistics to figure out how much does this part of the image contribute to the final classification? And they discovered it was just reading the barcodes. And there were certain hospitals that had a higher proportion of trauma victims, ergo a higher proportion of bone fractures, and that's all it was doing. It wasn't actually finding the hairline bone fractures. Both of these methods, despite supposedly high accuracy across a population, are not meaningful when applied to individuals. Alternatively, the network may not be accurate at all, but to recognize its bias may take time. A system that deprioritized black hospital patients did so because they had fewer health expenditures. But health expenditures are a useful proxy for sickliness only if sickly persons have access to affordable health care. And many African Americans do not. So they developed a system that was supposed to figure out which patients were sickest and needed the most urgent care, hoping to transcend the judgment of harried and exhausted emergency room triage personnel. They started putting these data points into a system because they thought if we can more infallibly or better classify incoming patients, we can figure out whom to treat first. And it always put the black people at the bottom of the list because one of the crucial data points it had learned to focus on was how much was spent on healthcare, which seems like it's going to be a useful measure, but only if you have money to spend on healthcare and healthcare in your area that you can afford. And a lot of these patients had neither. So perhaps they were even sicker. They were more sickly because they hadn't spent money on healthcare rather than less sickly because they had chosen not to spend money on healthcare. So it's the system wasn't doing what the human designers thought it was doing. But only the long-term failure of care outcomes and the racial correlation with care allocation could reveal the problem. In the physical world, a mangled steak or a tripping dance partner quickly proves the dullness of the carving knife or the inefficacy of the dance method. But a black box that seems to perform can be followed blindly because we've labeled the outputs according to our intended horizon of control. The network doesn't return a thing that says, this person spent more money on healthcare. It just says, this person is more sickly because I labeled the output for the measurement of the degree of sickliness. We expect the system to serve our horizon of control and to generate a good mapping, but because the system will generate a mapping, whether or not such a mapping can be achieved, it will give the appearance of success, and only long-term testing can determine whether it's doing what we hope it to do. Well, not only, you can also probe what it's most sensitive to, but sometimes these sensitivities are very subtle, and it's kind of difficult to tell what it's doing. Unable to see immediately whether or not the emperor has clothes, we allow the network to idolatrously replace reality because it gives us the appearance of control over dynamics that we do not understand. This, in turn, I'm just going to skip this section because we've kind of pretty much demonstrated it. This is how the network becomes a kind of reflection of the idolatrous mind, both because it's a decision-making and classification engine, a kind of artificial intelligentsia, and because it subsists and has its meaning within the scope of what we have determined actually matters. So it's our judgments of the goodness and import of a particular situation that shape the network all the way around, even though sometimes we have developed the network in order to have our judgments not be as deeply involved, to seek a more objective standpoint. So the solution, of course, is going to be that we have to become more objective in the ways that we can, rather than being very limited, crushing everything into a small data space and hoping that a network's going to be able to see further than what we've allowed it to see or label. All right, let's talk about the cost of idolatry and maybe some solutions. Is all of this really a problem? After all, it is nothing new to say that to a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. In other words, if we use neural networks for what they're really useful for, if we accurately interpret their output scope of meaning, then we won't have to go wrong. But this is not entirely true. The concept of idolatry points to systemic cognitive effects of how we treat AI. Our design of AI and our use of AI reshapes the way we think about things. Too often, AI is credited with an esoteric power to penetrate reality in a way that transcends the limits of human understanding. And while it certainly exceeds our powers of correlation and inference, contemporary machine learning cannot actually transcend the human horizon because it maps human gathered and labeled data to human interpreted outputs of classification and action. If we credit it with more, if we neglect the role of our own wills, then as the psalm warns concerning idols, they have eyes but they do not see, those who make them become like them, so do all who trust in them. That is, having made our idols to manipulate some sphere, we will be bound by what they can represent. Concretely, we may think of two cases, predictive policing in criminal justice and systems of medical treatment. PredPol and other such systems direct police units to anticipated hotspots of criminal activity. These are selected by networks and other systems trained on past reported crime events, correlations with the calendar date, weather conditions, locations of ATMs and convenience stores, and other environmental factors that seem to correlate in some way with crime. Patrolling these locations does appear to reduce the incidence of crimes, often less by arrest than by deterrent. Just the presence of the police prevents the crime from happening. By further updating the system, the hope is that it will improve and become ever more precise, so that limited police resources can be effectively assigned to control crime in a city. However, PredPol can't get outside of the human frame of reference. It cannot give us some sort of transhuman predictive insight, both because we choose and label the inputs and outputs, and because unexpectedly, the newer data coming into the system is shaped by police activity that has been guided by the system. Parents know this in families. It's the same thing. You catch one kid doing something wrong, you start waiting for that kid to do something wrong again, and that kid grows up being the kid who's always doing something wrong. And you believe it's true, and he believes it's true, and maybe he even starts doing it, because that's the best that can be expected of him. Crimes are reported not only by citizens, but also by police. Thus, when PredPol predicts an elevated crime rate, a greater police presence responds, possibly increasing the assessed crime rate because now officers will seek and find otherwise invisible infractions. These locations will then appear to be more distinctively crime-ridden than perhaps they actually are, biasing the system to continue to focus resources on these locations rather than others. We find what we look for, and when we look for it unevenly, we will find it unevenly and perhaps even reinforce it. Over-policing, more pervasive and aggressive police responses in assumedly high crime areas, more stops of innocent persons, more mistrust between the community and the police may exacerbate outcomes in the long term. When we feign independence from the world that we seek to control, when we ignore the fact that the system itself feeds on our own AI-driven interventions, then we can conform the world to the idol, in that the AI is a means of control and not just a response to the world. We risk deforming the world if we use it and believe it has an independent point of view. So I'm not saying that predictive policing shouldn't be done at all. It's just that when the predictive policing becomes a substitute for a fuller engagement with those areas of human society, then yes, it's going to distort things. The case of medical treatment is even more difficult. To some extent, medicine has always been a matter of treating what is not initially or perhaps ever understood. For instance, the attention deficit disorder has been treated with stimulant medications, I believe, since the early 80s. But it was discovered by accident that these medications helped children and adults with ADD. And since then, a body of theory and investigation has sought to identify exactly what's going on in the brain to figure out why the stimulants help. But initially, it was just observed that the children were happier, behaved better, and seemed to learn better in school and get along with other people when they were popping stimulants. For this reason, the diseases that we wish to treat, for instance, hepatitis A through E, are named for their symptoms. Hepatitis just means inflammation of the liver. It doesn't say anything about why the liver is inflamed, and not their causes, a number of viruses and transmission routes. And throughout the ages, medical treatments have at times targeted symptoms without actually addressing underlying conditions. For instance, my favorite, a wan paleness, perhaps due to anemia arising from an iron deficiency, was treated in Victorian times by arsenic, which restored a healthy glow to the cheeks. and was thought to clarify the complexion. Of course, we now know that in the short term, arsenic flushes the face by dilating its capillaries, but in the long term, it kills you. Only that long term revealed the ultimate death-dealing properties of the attempted treatment. So too in other cases. What may we do about idolatrous use of biased AI? Ethicists and computer scientists rightly address AI bias with case-by-case tweaks. They try to understand what the system is doing, why it's failing to do what you want it to, and then they try to change the training data or system architecture, et cetera, to compensate. But a theological perspective reminds us also that the ultimate context for intelligentsia, the ultimate context framing all goodness and meaning, the context wherein this problem could actually be resolved by the way we live our lives, must transcend human and artificial understanding. The context for rethinking and resolving the problem, finally, is God. This is why the two greatest commandments are, you shall love the Lord your God and neighbor, and you love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, and strength, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Engagement with reality, that is as successful as we can make it, which isn't necessarily going to solve every problem, but is the best we can do, must take place within the horizon of God. The Christian tradition holds that idolatrous pride is resolved by revelation and by love. God is the frame within which alone reality can be understood as it is, and not just according to our particular wills. And since no knowledge is possible apart from our particular loves, a true knowledge will ultimately always love the thing known in God. A true knowledge will also invite us to abandon the hope of total control and to love what we cannot repair. For Predpol, this means that when officers arrive at a predicted hotspot, they must arrive not as crime-seeking servants of the idol, but yes, as loving humans seeking to serve other humans. This is a rather simple solution, but it's one that was difficult long before machine learning came on the scene. And it was difficult because it is a human problem. In medicine, a true knowledge born in love, whether the doctor believes in God or not, must always be located within the higher goal of bringing a patient to health rather than of minimizing or maximizing particular measures, however reassuring they may be. At one point, a friend of mine was required to take a very powerful controlled medication for a condition that he had, but for some reason it wasn't showing up in his blood test because they were doing the wrong test, and they were accusing him of instead selling it instead of taking it because they couldn't confirm that he was taking it, but it was because their measures were wrong, and they were so focused on the numbers that they ran him through a very difficult process. I'm sure examples like this can be multiplied. Concretely, this means using AI to drive deeper insight into how conditions arise. But it also means that we will never be able to give up the responsibility for paying attention. We must not allow policing and medicine and other difficult societal activities to become dependent on AI, large language models, deep neural networks, or other inscrutable recommender systems. Our systems are good. We must use new technologies to aid us, but these systems must always augment rather than replace the attuned sensitivity of the doctor or of the officer who has long patrolled a neighborhood. But this is possible only when the AI system can point out why it has done something, or when we properly limit our expectation as to just what it can do. I'll conclude with a heartening example of how this can be done. Again, in medicine, with x-rays. A deep learning system was trained to correlate knee x-rays with patient-reported pain. It was the case that in a common knee operation, African-American patients had a longer period of recovery. They seemed to recover more slowly, and they reported more pain. In a more ancient time, this might have been dismissed as just, you know, the lower pain tolerance of the inferior African race or something like that. But luckily today, people didn't do that. And they were able to use an AI system to discover what was wrong. The surgeons were unaware of doing anything different with the African-American knees than with the Caucasian knees, nor could in the x-rays they observe anything different about the bone structure. It was not apparent in any way why these patients experienced more pain on recovery. So they trained a neural network system to correlate the x-rays with the expected reported pain. And when they had gotten that thing right, so where it could predict how many drugs these people would request after, what the degree of drugs they'd request after their surgery. And then they ran the network backwards to find which areas of the x-ray were most efficacious in predicting pain after the operation. And for this, they were able to discover how to modify the operation for African Americans so that they would experience less pain and recovery. They did discover subtle differences that the human beings hadn't themselves noticed and wouldn't have thought could matter. So this is a use of AI. The reason this AI worked was it because it involves the patient's intelligentsia, the patient's report of his own experience and understanding of what he's going through, correlated with the doctor's intelligentsia, the doctor pursuing a better pain outcome for the patient. The system draws the doctor to pay closer attention to the patient. It does not attempt solely to treat the symptoms, but uses the symptoms as symptoms of causes, and then uses artificial intelligence techniques to discover those causes. The temptation to serve idols in the end is exacerbated in part by the expense and understaffing of important professions. The professions with highest risk, risk to oneself in policing, and risk to the patients in medicine, highest burnout as well. These are the things where we really want to use AI. But of course, we hope for an efficacy that exceeds human abilities. But intelligence as the efficient achievement of quantifiable goals is never enough. And when the technologies that are meant to make it easier to deal with the world become obstacles between us and the world, reducing the world to a thing not to be understood but only to be controlled, then we implicitly accept a position ultimately of conflict with that world. What then must we do? We must develop and deploy AI tools that will lead us back to the wonder of the persons that we treat by striving to understand and by refusing the easy claim that an AI system works while bearing no relation to the processes of nature itself. To do no harm, then, or to serve and protect, means to refuse reduction. We have to reckon in some sense with the fullness of a world that has God himself as its source. So long as we keep ourselves as the users of our tools rather than being used by the tools, a tool that cannot accommodate the fullness of the world can still perhaps lead us to it by routes unexpected. But for this, we shall have to be lovers of God and of neighbor so that the tool will never finally satisfy us, and we will always return to the world that we seek to manipulate and to repair through the use of the tool. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.